Once I was asked by Gil Fronsdal, some of you know, to go and be his sort of stand-in for himself for 3 weeks while he went to Norway for a family holiday with his kids. And he had like multiple classes and sessions and things each week. And while I was there, soon after I got there, I got this raging cold and I really get sick. And I couldn't think what to say. This was a Monday night. And I didn't really know who to expect or anything really. And so I was thinking all day, what am I going to talk about? What am I going to talk about? And I just couldn't come up with anything. And even to the point that I sat down with everybody there and for 45 minutes I'm trying to think, what am I going to say? My mind was this thick fog. And I opened my eyes and there had been maybe 35 people when I closed my eyes, and when I opened them 45 minutes later there was like 100 people. They'd been sneaking in. I heard creaking but I didn't realize. And so then I just said, I have no idea what to say, so tell me what you want me to talk about. And so they just started asking questions, and it was great. That was 15 years ago or something, and it's like, oh, I don't have to know ahead of time. It'll come out. So ask me questions. See what comes out. And now it can be about what I've been teaching, or it can be now relevant to you being meditators in your life. So Sheila, hi.
I continue to have a terrible time stilling my mind. So it wanders tremendously. And so I do wonder whether I would benefit from spending some kind of more concentrated practice on concentration.
Yeah.
Because I know you said from your own experience that the you did do intensive concentration at one point. Mm-hmm. For a certain period, and that I'm wondering if that sort of sets the groundwork that makes relaxation even more effective.
It's a very interesting question. It's an interesting scenario, and partly interesting to me because of my background was that I sat Goenka retreats, and then I had that style for through the 80s and into the earlier part of the 90s. When in the end of the 88 was when I started sitting with Western teachers, and it was somewhere in the early 90s, 94 or so, where one of the Western teachers said to me, "Oh, and backing up, one of Goenka's styles is work. In fact, you hear his voice, he sort of chimes in with this voice as you're sitting there, work, work, work." So I'm like, you know, I'm already a strivey type, right? So like, just what I needed, a little more goading, and I'm like, Anyway, so this person, this Western teacher, said to me in the early 90s something about, well, the whole key to relaxation, to concentration, of course, is relaxation. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. What I've been doing for the 15 years is like work, you know. And so I had to unlearn. But I actually had to learn. I had to do that first because that's, you know, it's rather like you're clumsy to begin with any skill. You know, you hold your breath and you grip the bow. I don't know, I'm not a violinist, and I always use this analogy because I think that the trained mind is like a violin, and, you know, freedom is being able to, with beautiful music, come out of the violin. Well, you don't just play, you know, Tchaikovsky straight off the bat. There's a lot of gripping and and holding of the breath, and I'm sure struggling with the neck, I can't imagine. It takes time for it to be so light that you can go for the longest time and however they can. Unbelievable. So you unlearn bad habits. You know, you rarely do you start elegantly with anything. But your question, Sheila, about, well, there's a couple of things I want to say to you, but if we're too relaxed initially, right off the bat, we're giving permission to that frantic mind to go frantic. And so we can't be too relaxed. But we don't want to also be too tight, because when we're tight and trying, we're actually engaging that little mind in the trying. The wisdom part of the mind is only a relaxed state. So how to access that state? But we want to be able to both access and sustain that relaxed state. And so there's some work involved with doing that, because we're wanting to keep saying, no, I don't need to get so busy and so caught up. But there's some effort to saying no. There's something working there. Because otherwise, if you're just nothing but relaxed, as I said, the neurosis runs the show, and it's very powerful. So we need a basis of accessing awareness, mindfulness, the knower, the big mind, first. So we can relax with that. But to access that takes a little bit of work. And so it's a fine line. We're trying to relax the front of our mind, the busy part, the commenting, the judging, the figuring out, the rearranging deck chairs, that part. But we're not relaxing this like soft, quiet, this is what's happening. This is, and this too. Yes, this too. Yes, yes. That's not relaxed. It is already relaxed. Its nature is relaxation. But we're engaging it. We're not doing nothing. We're not just drifting. You know, it's deliberate. There's consciousness there. It's clarity. Another little thing I just wanted to get to, Sheila, the way you said your question was, I have a terrible time. That's very judgmental. Meaning to say, your mind is still, you know, it isn't mastered. It's still doing what you don't want it to be doing. Even still is a judging word. I shouldn't use that myself. Your mind is at times doing what you don't want it to be doing. It's thinking when you're attempting to not. You're wanting to not think so much. And you're seeing how much you're thinking. There's a piece, not just for you, but for everybody, that's very important, is we don't realize how neurotic we are until we start to see it. And it looks like we're getting more neurotic, but it's because we're seeing more of the neurosis that was always there. Initially, you might think you're fine. You're peaceful, your mind does what? Absolutely, your mind isn't crazy, you're not neurotic, what's she talking about? And then you sit there and you watch and you decide, I'm going to be with my breath. I'm going to be with my breath for the next 5 minutes. Good luck with it. It's like, my mind is not doing what I want it to do. I want to direct my mind to be grateful. And instead it's in the background going, meaning this is ridiculous, da 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 da, or something. And you see, oh yeah, this mind of mine has a will of its own. It has all these habits, it has all these activities that I'm actually not attempting to make it do. Why is it doing it? But you don't need to judge it as a terrible mind. It's busy trying to take care of you. It's trying to be your friend. It's just very inefficient at being your friend. It's making you happy. And the more stressed you are, the harder it works, and the more it's trying. It's frenetic. But it doesn't really work. It's exhausting you. Yeah. So we need to relax the trying and the looking for answers somewhere and the being so busy, but we don't to relax completely and just go to sleep because we're not learning anything. So relax the commenting, the chattering, the judging, and it's a matter of learning to trust that doing less is in fact more useful. We think that doing more and being busier is going to get further and be more effective because that's the way we've always done it. You know, can you believe that just sitting quietly and noticing the fact that you're in a room in a basement that doesn't have carpets on the floor and that we can hear that rumbling motor, maybe it's the fridge, maybe it's the heating system. Just being present for my knee is slightly sore is helpful. We don't trust that that's helpful. We don't trust that not thinking and planning and going ahead and going into the past is in fact itself useful. So that's why you have to be taught and you keep practicing over and over until you realize to engage the knowing is much more helpful, and to disengage all the commentary, that is actually much more helpful than ignoring the knowing and being completely absorbed in all the busy activity. So a concentration as a practice, deliberately, it's one of the forms, it's, you know, one of the foundational forms of techniques anyway. And the thing about that is it takes a long time. I mean, it takes days and days and days and days of hours and hours and hours and hours of sitting for the mind to get quiet enough without enough stimulus and without having to deal with anything for it to happen. And even though I'd done a lot of practice when I began doing concentration as a specific thing, it took me days, weeks for it to really, really get still. So it's an unrealistic ambition for most of us, not available for most people. If you can take 3 months, fantastic. You know, you can then access it, but not so useful in a shorter period of time. But the benefit of being able to, it really does, it really brings confidence. You realize the mind is really trainable and it's possible to not think so much. And from that place, you really can see clearly how silly a lot of the thinking is. But when you're in the thinking, it's hard to have that perspective. You know, when you can actually really be outside of that busy mind that's thinking things, you can see a lot about what it's like. But it's not, it's just not realistically available for a lot of people. I highly recommend it, though, if you can. Take some time, at least a month-long retreat, 6 weeks probably, but minimum length of time for have some real concentration to establish, I would say. Is that useful? Is those answers helpful? Thank you, Sheila. Don't judge your mind as terrible, please. I know you didn't mean it. It was just a figure of speech. I know. But the busy little mind, yeah. It's the holder which is calm. And we're not trying to sledgehammer that bird down. Please.
Since you mentioned Goenka, I've often considered going on one.
Yeah.
But I've been chicken because I've heard so many stories.
Yeah, we do have a sort of attitude in the Western teachers of calling those retreats boot camp. But when you've done practice and you've done some practice, if you can take care of yourself and relax your mind and not let yourself get too tight around it, one of the things is that there's no walking meditation. There's just sitting, and then you can just take 5 minutes and you're sitting again. And then on the third day through the tenth day, each day there are three sittings of great determination, 1 hour long. And those are sittings where you're encouraged not to move your eyes, not to move your hands, or not to move your legs. In other words, don't move. And so that can be quite a setup for you to get quite tight with yourself. But it can also be quite revelatory, and it was in my case. You know, after, I don't know how many, several, I realized I was causing my own distress by getting all tight in there. And I could just sit back and just be still, and I didn't have to oppress myself in that confined practice. So then I realized that the anxiety and the pressure, the discomfort and all the aches and things that were going on were all because I was fighting sitting still. I was like, oh my God, I don't know if I can do this much longer. Oh, when are they going to ring the bell? That kind of thing. And when that all relaxed, all the anxiety and all the tensions of the body and the energy body relaxed, and it wasn't painful at all. And it was like, wow.
Supervised? Like, who's there to know if you move your
eyes? I don't know. I think probably just my own guilty conscience, because I try and be good, you know. I was trying to do what I was told to do, and so I was imposing from the external expectation. I was adding my own judge to that, because I was very good at judging myself. Well, you'd have to see. I have no idea. Well, they're not, like, they don't have barbed wire fences and guards or anything, you know. You're not locked in there. But they discourage you. They said, just tough it out and see, you know. And so it's challenging. But, you know, that's okay. You can get, you're not going to, nothing serious is going to happen. I'm a rebellious also, and so where I used to go was a place in the most often place was in near Port Townsend in Washington State, and they rented a big facility that had been once a army station during the war. So it was barracks. We were sleeping in barracks, you know, like 40 people in one room and stuff, and they had string outside, 10 yards outside the buildings, and you weren't allowed to cross the string. so they could keep psychically you protected or something like that. And so I'm like, forget that. So I'd cross it when I go walking along the cliffs, being a rebel, which gave my spirit some space. And so I did that. And they didn't come after me and drag me back or anything. It was fine. So but I gave myself some permissions like that. Yes.
As a somatic psychotherapist, and so appreciate the beauty of those principles. So I was a bit shocked at the dogmatic element of the presentation, and I had some physical things going on when I first arrived, and I'm also a clinical healing energy medicine practitioner, so my first sitting, had a lot going on, and I mentioned that to the teacher, and afterwards she asked if I wanted some Tylenol, and I said no, I sedated gallbladder to help, but you can't do that here, and I have to ask you if this is a right place for you to be at this time, and I'm saying, so help me understand how I can take Tylenol, but I can't
yes.
do acupressure,
yeah,
because that's pushing it away,
yes.
And everything's energy, so I just and the statement that riding two horses is dangerous, so I get the desire to protect a practice to help people be exposed to it, but I'm really uncomfortable when there's a presentation that says this is the way, and if you can't choose this way, it's not for you. So I appreciate all that is aligned with the Buddhist principles, and there's lots that's beautiful, but anytime there's, you have to choose this way to the exclusion of others, it makes me uncomfortable.
Me too.
So,
me too. That's why I'm here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lots of good, great techniques, but some buts. Yeah. But when you've got some experience like you have, you know, take what is good and useful and apply it, and then don't take what isn't. And that was the Buddha's teaching. He said, come and see for yourself. And if this is helpful, do this. If it's not so helpful for you, don't do that. Do what is helpful for you. And so he gave permission for us to find our way by offering us these various teachings. And so you just do it that way. So, yes. Hi.
I think I'm not some kind of expert Buddhist, but somewhat outside of traditional Buddhist teachings. But do you find in your meditating that if you open yourself up and clear your mind, that you are able to take in other outside of yourself, your own mental capacities, spiritual mental influences, for instance, in the forest, or you know, Tamna Shadan's concept of the new sphere, or whatever, spiritual elders, guides. In your experience, is it possible to access any of those?
Yes, what I find, that's an interesting question. What's your name?
David.
Thank you, David. Could you hear David's question? What I found is that what goes on for me, I don't remember how long ago, because this has been sort of a long-term journey for me, but what I find is that my mind interprets, it's rather like speaking another language, and how that you can translate that and get the meaning of the language for yourself. And it's kind of like that. So if I hear teachings in a different language than the early Buddhist language, it translates it into early Buddhist language for me, and I understand what they're saying. And so it makes sense. And so whether it's Christian teachings, I was singing in a little choir, and we were singing, you know, Christmas carols. Some of them I can't stand it, because I don't actually believe in some of it. But some of it is exactly what I do. It feels absolutely the same to me. And so it's just a matter of translating the meaning of the odd word and finding that actually the kingdom of God is the same thing as awakening. You know, and so you just use, it's just language, it's just words, actually. What's the essence of it all is I don't think it's any different. When somebody expresses some state of realization, what they're realizing is the experience of freedom from suffering. That's the language of the Buddha, but the experience is the same experience, whether they're an Eckhart Tolle telling you, or whether they're a Adyashanti telling you, or whether they're a Ramana Maharshi telling you, or, you know, or they all are saying the same thing, you realize. And so, yes, I just think it's particular forms that we happen to have encountered or prefer or are familiar with or that we relate to, that we like, that, but that I don't think that, which is why I agree with what you were saying. I didn't ask your name. It's just to say that, no, this is the way and that way is not the way. It doesn't feel right at all with me because I think they're all roads leading to Rome, and the intention is we would like all to have our, as I asked you yesterday morning, why do you meditate? You know, and it's like the answers we give are all slightly different, but they're all the same, actually. We're wanting to have well-being in our lives, goodness, wisdom, kindness, care. We don't want stress, anxiety, confusion, hatred, you know, in our lives, you know, and it doesn't really matter the language. That's where I'm coming from. So I don't feel it's alien. Unless there's basic principles, like I basically don't feel comfortable with that I'm born in sin, and unless I believe in a particular person and their fate that will save me, that I don't actually believe that. And so that I have argument with in myself. But underneath that, the teachings of Christ, I don't have any argument with at all. It's like it's the same thing. Yeah. Yeah. I actually really like reading other. That's why I like reading Mary Oliver poems or, you know, Thomas Merton or Einstein, for goodness sake, you know. He talked to, so we have this delusion going on in our mind that we think we're the center of the universe. And, you know, clearly that's misinformation. Even the philosophers, yeah, I find it reassuring rather than alienating. Yeah, yeah. Yes, yes, yes. I know, it's fascinating. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then, you know, then people like Jill Bote Taylor and, you know, what's that amazing book? One of my favorite books a few years ago, Ian McGilchrist wrote a book called The Master and His Emissary. And he's talking about the two hemispheres of the brain through the history of the Western civilization since the Greeks. It's a fantastic book. You know, I love that kind of thing. I'm interested in how the brain functions, really. But and spiritual liberation, how we experience it. Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to get too philosophical this afternoon, because I am trying to be a meditation teacher. But anyway, it's good questions. Other people? Anything burning high?
It's not burning. But,
okay.
And I might already know the answer, but I'll ask you anyways. So I've been practicing Soto Zen, and I love it.
Yep.
I love the history, the absolute irrationality.
Yes.
Poetry, but I sit there and I get so uptight, and I strive, like you said.
Strive.
I sit there striving, and I literally feel like the top of my head's
blowing off.
Now. Is it a question of relax?
Yes.
Relaxment.
It is. But listen to that tone of voice.
Yes, I know, I was judging, wasn't I?
Very, and bossy.
But
militaristic, it's an approach. It's a, so, you know, I mean, you think of the history of the culture through which these places, you know, these teachings come, and some of the mode of that,
right.
You know, some of the mode of the militaristic, you know, and precision of the Japanese culture,
yeah.
You know, it's quite a masculine strictness, clarity, cleanness also. There's lots of beauty, of course, tea ceremonies, unbelievable, but there's the Buddha himself, you know, where Buddhism originally came from, was much more see for yourself.
Yeah.
Experiment was his approach, really. Here are guidelines. See if this is true. See if your mind actually is where your happiness and unhappiness resides rather than circumstance. See if that's not true. See if it's your relationship to what's happening. Are you making yourself wanting or resisting or missing experience because of its pleasantness, unpleasantness, or in-betweenness? Is that true for you? And then you explore and see for yourself. But you do need to be able to look. And you need to know how to look and see that for yourself. And if you're engaged in judgment, you won't be able to see that.
Yeah.
So this ability of the skill in the teachings of the Buddha, and he gave us these four foundations, is mindfulness. you know, meaning being able to be residing in the knowing. But it was Suzuki Roshi, the first Japanese, you know, Zen master to come to North America, who said, "We're attempting to be a courteous audience." Rather than the, you know, central players on the stage, you know, and like that is a really brilliant analogy. I love that analogy. And I'll translate that and say, are you on the couch or are you in the TV? You know, at any moment, and you're most of the time in the TV, and then suddenly, whoop, you're on the couch realizing that was ridiculous. And then the next minute you're in the TV acting out all of that, whatever it is, you know, drama or fear, and then you sit back and you realize, wow, I was so caught up in that frustration, and then whoop, you're in again. And so, but being able to see that happening, the coming and going of your identification and being in the sort of on the front lines, as it were, that's what's liberating. Yes.
Traditional Japanese culture.
Yes.
It's not like that now.
No, you don't like those plastic teddy bears.
I'm not saying
sorry.
Yeah, sure. But I think it's because Dogens and Suzuki, I mean, they just really
wonderful.
Parked in, right?
Yeah.
They made it soft.
Yeah.
It's soft.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm getting too hooked into the authority. What I think is right.
Listen to the tone of voice.
Yeah.
Listen to that tone.
Because
It's receptive. It's the right hemisphere is soft. It's open. It's receiving. It's palms. It's this is how this is, and it's holding with care and respect.
Yeah.
That attitude is a liberated state, and the other that's judgy, that's trying, that's pushing, that's like frustrated. All of that is the fingers that are overdoing it. And so, but it's so hard not to, because that's the way we've done it, and we function that way already and in our world. And so we're attempting to withdraw from, so why I like this analogy, because it's like, I think of juice, our attention as being like right out there. We want to come back and just sit back and hear and receive and then hold. So it's to do with relaxing. It's also kindness, and that's another emphasis which I think is missing and hugely important. And depending on the teacher, I mean, I remember I was with Utejaniya, and I said, "What about metta? What about kindness in here?" And he just said, "I don't teach that." And I'm like, "Well, I need that." Whereas this other Asian teacher, Bhante Gunaratna, says, "I'm not going to teach you anything until you've done 3 years of metta." You know, like, so it depends on how people's experience has made it through, and they'll teach their way. Fortunately, people teach what's true for themselves, and so we find our own way there. But I think kindness, when you've got that, like, tension, as soon as there's stress, we want to relax it, but one of the ways to relax it is gratitude. One of the ways to relax it is kindness. There's a fabulous book by a philosopher, a psychologist, Earth is his name. Ferrucci, F-E-R-R-U-C-C-I. Can't remember his first name. Italian. And it's called I often carry it with me. The something of kindness. The Art of Kindness. Beautiful, beautiful book. Devoted to that, you know. And it's about the softening that happens when you come into the heart. So that's the sort of the mean driver in the head. Oh, I've got to do this, I shouldn't do this, that's strife.
Yeah.
Come into the heart and be grateful. Come into the heart and be kind. Come into the heart and be soft and patient and tender. And then that all of that isn't so engaged. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Thank you for asking. Hi.
Hi, Jennifer.
I
was lucky enough to spend 6 night at Spirit Rock in December.
No.
And it was absolutely lovely. And it was yoga, mindful movement, and meditation.
Uh-huh.
And we spent a lot of time, four teachers, and we spent a lot of time in the middle way, you know, not too tight, not too loose. And tuning the lute was the metaphor for the week. But what, you know, sort of what I've been thinking about since returning from that is that the middle way and, you know, kindness and sort of your what you have referred to as the steady gaze.
Mm.
If how does one become active when they see something that's wrong?
Oh yes, that's a really important question.
And I know that the you know the Western Buddhist psychology background people are really discussing this now.
Yes.
There's a lot of blogs and but I would really appreciate your
Okay. Well. Yes, I'll repeat the question. I'm sorry. Thank you. So Jennifer was saying, the heart of your question was, how do you make a decision when you see that something is wrong? For instance, from being relaxed, being present, holding, and yet something's wrong.
And so the idea of equanimity, you know, that's what you're trying to maintain.
Yes.
But then suddenly, if you're outside of your bubble, and someone says something that you find absolutely
offensive or harmful or yeah.
And then you want okay.
How do you be kind? How do you do that? So it's tricky. It's an interesting question. So one of the ways I answer this kind of question is that there are, as well as two minds, which is one way of this is what helps me. There's the forward mind and there's the back mind. Is to think of it as two realities. In fact, this is taught in some of the Buddhist teachings, that there is what's called relative reality and then there's ultimate reality. It's the same thing, really. The relative is the interactive world where we relate to each other on the way we normally do, on the level that we normally do, which is the world of duality, meaning you're Jennifer and I'm Heather, and I have that white Subaru and that's mine, and you can't have it. And I'm going to take this route and you're going to take another route in another car, and you're going to put different shoes on than mine, and we're definitely different. That's relative reality. And from that place, we have judging and right and wrong and more and less and friends and foes and, you know, things that taste good and that don't taste good. All of those qualitative experiences are on that relative, out of that relative state. So going on in the background is the ultimate reality, an ultimate reality or spiritual dimension, where what also is true is that we are human. We are friends. You know, we are breathing the same air. We are made of the same molecules. We're all stardust. We're all earth sprouts. There's ways of, you know, we're all Canadian, middle-aged female, turns out, you know. In fact, we're a lot more similar than we are separate. And so in this reality, then there is love, connection, understanding, and all of those things come in that dimension. So the difficulty is trying to deal with one level from another level. Which is which? It's confusing. In meditation, we're trying to access and stabilize contact with the bigger, the wiser spiritual dimension, the ultimate dimension. Your question is about something happening on the relative level. Somebody who's not you says something to you that hurts you, let's say. And so that's separate from you, and it has that impact, and it's hurtful. So from a relative point of view, ouch, and maybe reaction, or maybe don't do that, or how dare you, or go away, or something. And from an ultimate view, it's like, that was painful. And so when we, and equanimity is like, yes, life is painful sometimes. This is the eight vicissitude country, and people are going to say these things, and it isn't personal. It's just they're having a bad day, and so I'm in their way, and so I'm their difficult person right now, and so they're insulting me, and that's what's happening. And so that's the spiritual place, kind of. So what we're wanting to do is engage both those. But sometimes when that behavior, say, persists or is inappropriate, then we need to get down from being, oh, well, to, excuse me, but, you know, that's not okay. And so we want to be able to function on both levels. It's not that this is the right and this is the wrong or this is unnecessary or this is reality. And so is this reality. We want both to be functional. When we have access to this one, then we can say, this person is having a hard time. I'm going to tell a story now, which I haven't told for a few years, but I've told many times. So those of you in this room who've heard it half a dozen times, you're hearing it again. It's an example. So my friend's name is Carol, and she's Irish, and she's happens to be the 13th of in a Catholic family, and her mother was visiting her in Vancouver from Ireland, and this is Carol's mother's story. And one day she needed to go, Carol's mother, to get some money exchanged at the bank, so they went together to the bank, and they were waiting, and she was a tiny little Irish old lady, She went up to the teller when it was her turn, and Carol stayed back and waited and watched her mother go to the teller. And after a while, she could see that the teller was being, like, really apparently mean to her mother. And she's this little old lady, and so Carol was feeling really protective. And so she, to the point, couldn't stand it. So she walked up beside her mother to the teller to tell her off, really, to kind of get her to... Just in time to hear her little old Irish mother lean forward and say to this teller, "Have you ever thought of doing different kind of work, dear?" So she was engaging that mean teller and telling her, "You're actually treating me poorly." But she was doing it from a place of quite compassion and realizing she's in the wrong job, you know. She shouldn't be dealing with the public. She should be dealing with something else, you know, clothing maybe. And so, but she's able to not take it personally. She's not triggered into reactivity. She's not caught on the relative, but she's acting in the relative with access to compassion, understanding, equanimity, kindness. That's just an example of, like, she's a baby Buddha doing her thing there. And so we want to be able to access our wisdom, which we gain access to by meditating, so that when we encounter the things we encounter, we can bring some space, some understanding, some compassion, some patience, some tolerance, some capacity to deal with all of these neurotic people, including our own neurotic mind, rather than get caught in straight aversion, you know, straight judgment, you know, the limited versions of the relative world. And so that's what we're attempting to do. And the more we practice, the more we discover that things either go by us or off our backs more easily, or we're able to see more of what's going on because we can see a bigger picture because we have more space. But when we have less access to that and we get something really triggers us, something touches our really weak spot, like members of our family typically do, you know, then we find that we've lost equanimity, we've lost any compassion, we've forgotten that they're a person who has needs, and they're just like, "Don't do that to me," and I, you know, and then we go like, "Oh, I only lose it with my sister," or, you know, and so it's like that. That then again we go like, "Oh, I can't remember." So there, sometimes I forget, I just forget that she is, you know, and so we need to hold that with care too. With more practice, there's more kindness, there's more humor, there's more forgiveness, there's more accommodation. It just, but it's not like a switch goes and now that's it. Now you, if it was that simple, we'd all be, look at us, we've been doing decades of meditation, we'd all be flawlessly, you know, reliably awakened. There isn't such a thing as awakenedness as a thing. It's an experience that's momentary. Momentary experiences of states of awakening, and then they pass, and then we don't have them, and then we have them, and we don't have. But with more practice, and we're practicing being conscious of what's happening, conscious of when we're small and shrunken, and conscious of when we're more expanded and more spacious and calm, and we make those more conscious, more and more and more. That's what we're doing, really. But mindfulness is consciousness, another way of saying it, aware of it. And as that happens, we don't spend so much time lost in the confusion because we're aware that we're struggling. And so why would we don't do it if we realize we're doing it so much. So we're finding ourselves less and less caught. It's an ongoing journey. But there are certain things which are angry tellers for lots of people. Yeah. Please, hi. Yes. Yes. And so it's huge. It's huge. And we're living in this world. And there is injustice, as you know, and of course our climate. And so the thing is, we need a little moment to not just react. So for me, what I say is, let's be proactive. Let's not be reactive. Reactive is automatic, unconscious. We're touched into something and we have this knee-jerk aversion or blame, you know, fear, all those things. We need to access some discernment. This is not good. This shouldn't be allowed to continue. This is unjust. This is dangerous. This is harmful. But it's when it's seen from a place of understanding rather than like immediately fighting right back, we're just perpetuating a problem. So we need to have a little bit of space and calm to consider, oh, and then we can make a choice. With some space, we can choose to say something rather than it comes out of our mouth unbidden, as it were, like automatic. We don't want to be on automatic. That's dangerous. Or these are too busy running the show. We need to take a step back, take a moment, take a breath. Okay. And we find that increasingly we have that space as we meditate so that we're not going to be so caught in reactivity and we'll be more like Carol's mother. You know, so, but with all those things, but there's plenty of things that are wrong, that are unacceptable. Another thing that people ask, and it's in the same vein, is what about the word accept? Because, you know, if I'm going to accept, am I going to accept greed, and am I going to accept cruelty, and it's unacceptable. And so rather than the word accept, which no one has asked, but that's what we carry a lot, that is a tricky word. I prefer the word allow or receive. Like that behavior, let's say there's harmful behavior. Greed is why we have depleted the resources and we keep on depleting because we just don't want to give up the things we like, okay? Like fast cars or flying around for fun. So, completely, you know, so it happens to not just old people, but all of us. The flow of the sentence went, oh, where did that go? Allow, thank you very much. So we can receive the fact that, yes, there is greed and that's what's causing the problem. Okay. So I'm not saying that's not so, or I'm not rejecting that. I'm receiving that that's happening. And then I'm saying, and that is harmful. And so I don't want to perpetuate that. So I'm going to say no to that behavior as best I can, having first said, yes, that's what's happening. So I receive it. So I know about it, so I'm not denying it, I'm not pretending or sort of slamming it before I've received it and can let it in. And then when it's in, then I can say, I can then choose, no, I'm not going to do more of that. I'm not going to take that extra trip. I don't need that trip. That will just pollute even more. But I have received first. I'm not accepting exactly, I'm receiving and then choosing against. I don't know if that's making sense. It's hard in the English language. The English language isn't equipped for this. Is that useful? Okay. So we could chat all day, but actually we're on a meditation retreat, so we're going to stop the talking, if that's okay. Thank you for your questions. I make the opportunity because it's good, part of it. Now we need to just settle and reflect with that.